Well, I guess when you really look at the limitations of what the soil is going to do, because that's what you're building the road out of. So the soil scientist actually is the author of this, but really, pretty simply, you see the maps. We're looking at the mostly clays overlaying some shale. And the reason that's predominantly what the soil types are, even though up higher you see some sandstone outcrops, is this used to be an old inland sea, so there's a lot of clays and sediment. Normally you think clay, that's what I'm thinking, but then you start to think about inland sea, sooner or later you get too much salt. So that's one of the biggest concerns. And when you get to looking at along here where the ridge is, you actually see the Bullwacker drainage to the east and then right fully. When you really look at what was going on geologically in the glacial age, when the Missouri River cut down a new channel, now you've got this inland sea way above that, and everything is trying to reach equilibrium, and that's where the erosion takes place. So we'll just go through some of these examples. The top 10 things we look at are self-explanatory. The steeper it is, you get water running on it, the more material it's going to take. And they're with these kind of soils, there's an erosion hazard, and the soil is prone to slumps and very shallow. You've got something you build on a shale is below it. Nothing, the water isn't going to permeate through the shale, so naturally you saturate everything and then it slides down here. So we would classify this, a lot of these soils have a low reclamation potential, and then they're prone to piping and sinkholes. We'll see an example of that. And then, really, they do have low soil strength, even though they're clays, but they actually don't have they're not a very good foundation once they get wet. And again, number 8, the corrosive soil, that's the salt, if you put a steel over it out there, it would rust immediately. And that shallow depth of saturation, that's what I was referred to as everything on top of the shale that won't take water. And then the head cuts, that's really caused from, there's quite an elevation difference between where we are and the Missouri River. So some of the head cuts and the drainages are prone to move quite a bit. So some of the examples you see here, when you look at this photo here, you see that you're in the underlying shale. Look at, there's really not a whole lot of soil on top of that. So once you disturb that, you have to put it back into where it's protected. And the best protection is a good rip mask with grass and different shrubs. You see how much grass there is, and that's not the biggest disturbance. So that's a problem. And then when you actually see these two photographs are roughly in the same place, that's a sinkhole. That's where it's kind of got a low spot and the water's actually set in there, and then actually material washes down or pipes below, and it's actually runs down into this drainage right next to it. So that's a bad place to put to build anything on top of it. And that is exactly what we're doing. And then again, you see some of the head cuts, that's just the erosion working its way back upstream. And then you see the salt line. And then you see a pretty good drainage that's got another salt line that would be on both sides. and this is actually wet all the time. So just think of that as a salty, wet clay foundation. That's not a very good place to build anything on top of. So you got to do some extra things to keep the culvert in this drain. So, and again, I'll refer to my friend, the soil scientist. You know, I basically, you can see what he thinks of engineering. There's a lot of truth to this. Things are, as that sets right now, there's a lot of things are in equilibrium a little bit, but they're, you know, the head cuts are occurring, and the everything that is undisturbed is probably as stable a condition as it's going to be. And then once you start disturbing it, when you dig into it where you're in the shale and it doesn't grow grass anymore, you've got problems. So those are the challenges we face. Any questions? I'll switch back to Mike.
Thanks, John. So as we spent more time on site, we started seeing more and more difficulties in trying to cross some of these problematic soil areas. And in general, this is the higher country here. As it goes east or west or south, it gets deeper and deeper. This is right where you see it starts deeper and deeper and deeper. Same thing, Bullwhacker, deeper and deeper and deeper. So the problems that we saw with the soils can generally get worse the further east and west we go, and the further south. And generally, again, the same situation is worse to the south than it is as it fully gets deeper and deeper and deeper. So one of the first things you looked at is, like, are these four alternatives? We really have four alternatives. And we started looking at a couple that we just couldn't support. And the right pulley one I'll deal with first. And once again, right pulley is this large drainage that goes down to the down into Cow Creek. And we started looking way down at this region, all the way back, looking for a place to cross this. Okay, first right pulley. At first the blush, it doesn't look that bad, but as we got into it more and more, we started seeing more steep slopes, and across from us saw some fossil landslides, many trees, pistol grip trees, and trees where the bud is curved or the soil is actually moving down the hill. Like this, you see the trees, the whole hillside is creeping down. And try as we could, here's a old slump right here. It doesn't look that bad, but this used to be up there. And this is not an obvious place not to build a road if you want to keep it there in a long period of time. And the road we're talking about potentially building would be one like the road that exists currently, which we probably call a local road or collect a local collector road. But it would be a road that would allow, at least during the dry part of the year, two-wheel drive access, maybe high clearance, but it would be a constructed road with drainage features. It wouldn't be something just a path across the landscape. So that gets more difficult all the time in this type of situation. Where do you put a road in here? Another large head cut and slump associated with the right pulley. So it ended up, we looked, and the further we went down right pulley, the worse it got. We just could not find any place logically that we could say we could build a road using normal engineering design and construction features. Normal being normal equipment, normal grading, nothing putting in excessive structures, rather, just normal grading structures and normal road. The second opportunity was Butch Reservoir. It's a small reservoir east of the private property, and it has a dam across it. We thought we could use that old road as an access point. But once again, this is very much in doubt, as just these last two storms we had last summer, it seems to have been here 2 years, we got 200-year storms already. But this is the outlet for that small lake, and this is now immediately below it. It's not a stable feature. Once again, we looked and looked, trying to find a way to make this work. We just couldn't find a way across the soil, the mantle of soil. It's just unstable all the way down. So that pretty well took us out of those two, the Spencer Ridge route or the Butch Reservoir, Wright Cooley route, because this wasn't the way to look across that. But we did find two alternatives that we believe physically we could build a road using, once again, normal construction design. And one is we have the east route and the west route. What I'd like to do is take just a short pictorial view, around 25, 30 slides of each, to show you what the landscape looks like and some of the things we discovered. So the east route, and the east route, we're going to show a map here, but we're going to be traveling north to south, so the Tom Island Road down south. It starts out, it's a wide open landscape, a large landscape, a lot of alternatives where to go. Very low tree cover. Of course, any road we built would be very visible. But the entire east side route is also general sage-grouse habitat. And typically they prefer areas like this that are wide open. There's a old fossil couple tracks we followed. And we tried to, the east side is typified with lands like this. Relatively easy rolling construction, then it's punctuated by three large coulees. And the private land is approximately, all the private land boundary is right on top of this small view, about like that, I recall. Over that, and this is public land, and that is private over there. So potential route we looked at once again by following the existing property line. We're trying to avoid the deeper, more erosive, and more difficult coulee construction. Here's the first coulee crossing we come to. There are three of these large coulees, relatively steep, fairly stable, but not necessarily guaranteed. This is a small gas line that's buried here following that route. Obviously, we could take a road following that same route, but we looked, taking a road up and around out of the picture, it's still deep, but it's passable. And then once again, we're in this large open landscape that follows the east side approximately. This is 5.8 miles to get back from the Cow Island Road to the back around the Bullwhacker Road. Small copses of trees, but primarily an open country. It's a very large landscape that one could move around very many different possible routes in here. But generally, once again, to the east, it gets worse. So this does exist. We have a flag route all the way down with this flag and living on it. This is the old gas line. Fairly easy construction with the exception of these three major coulees we have to cross.
Could you back up that?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, we put this slide in there for a reason. It's the only one that's looking back north, but you can see down at the bottom, that two track, just that amount of disturbances expose that gas line. And if we want to use that route, we're going to have to move over a little. There's no way you're going to, if you cross any major drainage where that gas line is, you're going to move the gas line. Have to move the gas line or find a different place for the road. But it's really not very, very, very deep. So there are several places that you can actually see it if you walk the road.
Okay, thanks, bro.
Is that gas line going to roll into explosion? Covered at one time?
Oh, yeah, certainly it was. It's still.
I think a lot of places you see it as more. They didn't get it deep enough in that spot, and they got it where the water ran, so it's kind of a combination of both.
Okay, here's a second coulee crossing, and it's also a deep coulee. It tends to be punctuated, curves are quite steep. you'd have large fills. You can imagine you'd have to have a relatively large pipe to carry the flow of water to build this road. We talked about the potential cost, very rough cost figures, but this project, the east side has less drainage structures, but they're larger. But this road could be quite expensive for its completion.
Did you have an approximate number?
Carl, what are we're thinking it's probably, this is very rough.
I would put the east one in around the 600,000 range. And that's based on some very rough.
Right, and if you don't run into any huge headaches or something.
We're also anticipating the west route would probably be 40-50% more expensive.
When you see those slides.
Figure again.
Roughly what? $600,000? And this is very rough. We're just looking at the modest drainage structures on the road. This will not be bringing gravel in. This is rather using native earth, building a swale, building up a surface, a drivable surface. So,
John, we're pretty reluctant to offer any estimates there, but certainly it would be an expensive venture.
Oh, yeah.
And the west side, the big thing is general, the west side could be more expensive.
Mm-hmm. And that doesn't include maintenance?
No, not at all. And once again, what did we learn about the east side? It is mapped as sage grouse habitat. Our crews did see sage grouse out there. There's also elk. We saw elk out there, deer, antelope. It's obviously very visible. Any construction we'd be built on this, it's like, say, it's a most of this area reclaims very slowly, be very visible at least for quite a few years. There's a high soil contrast, so it would be, those are some of the impacts we saw immediately that we thought we would see. And it just gets more open as we go to the south. And this, the private, the existing road is about there. And we're going to come here and join it roughly over there. The public land. That was we're just moving closer to the same view we had previously. And there's the existing Bullwacker Road. And they hauled cattle out of it this year. When I was there, there was a fair amount of traffic down it for the people hauling cattle out of trucks. And just again, I'm going to go back to the map now. That's into the east side. And what we did is we went right from those pictures, came right from the Tom Island Road, virtually heading following this direction, dead south. And here's that last picture right there, the Bullwacker Road. Once again, we're trying to stay as close as possible to the private land boundary to avoid more construction costs and difficulties. And now we're going to look at the west side. The west side is somewhat different. Once again, we'll be traveling north to south. And we start on this is the Bullwacker Road, where we turn off the Cow Island Road. The private land, approximately right here at the boundary. And where we were going to look at, we're going to use this road, we're going to take off about here on the road, there it is, and then go to the southwest. You'll see it on the map. There's a bit of the top, both the north and the south portions of this route are also sage grouse habitat. The center part of you get into more forested landscape. Now this route starts out very easily, and there's about Carl, how many coulee or how many crossings do you think drainage structure are going to have?
On the west, I physically walking the route, thinking where you would have to move water, you'd have 61 culverts.
Give me the microphone, please.
Sure. On the west side, you just walking through the route, once it's flagged, I estimated you'd have 61 different places you put in a culvert. And on the east, there was 43. So it gets a little rougher, and it stays rougher than the open sagebrush that you saw on the other side.
Thanks, Carl. We get into this is our first small coulee crossing, and once again you can see it's hit there. Oops, excuse me. we have several small patches of trees and several small coulees in the first mile. And we're headed, this is the existing fence on the private land. We're going right along a small pond. If we look at this as possibly crossing, this is immediately below that. The coulees, like I say, they start cutting down very quickly to the west. We start getting some small stands of timber. Some instability here. We have some big, large sinkholes. This is our first, probably our most difficult coulee crossing on this route on the west side. You see, we have to get across, and that's probably 30 vertical feet down, dropping down in there. So it's and the private land boundary is very close to the left side of this slide. So we have to cross this. And the route would roughly be, we're going to follow its flag going up to that saddle, and then following up to that saddle. And once all we're doing is just virtually following the property line around. And we have a little bit of sage-grouse habitat on this side also. And where we're headed, the existing road is right up here, and we're going to go right more or less like that saddle. That's up to that one tree back in this picture right there. And you see the tree cluster is going right just to the left-hand side of that tree. We get up on top again, and the landscape changes now. It starts rolling in and out of the timber. Road tops is the timbers. We're not in sage-grouse habitat here, but there's a lot of elk, obviously elk use and elk sign in this area. It's an elk kind of thing. We cross, oh gosh, must be half a dozen of these roads at least in the last 3 miles of this route. This route's about 4 miles around the corner, and we cross half a dozen of these coulees. It's up and down, the rolls. There's the next one. They're steeper than they look also from the slides. Potential positives about this side, the route is, well, besides not as much sage-grouse habitat, it also is less seen. Once you get around into the timber, it would probably disguise much of the construction area compared to those on the east side. Another coulee, up and over, it's rolls. We hit this is a road down to one of the existing gas well. We use it for a short period, about 100 yards. Then we go back, heading dead south again. The last two coulees the first coulee and the last two are the most difficult crossings on this route. This would be, that's where we're trying to get to there. There's an existing road down that ridge. And that's where we're trying to, open road, that's where we're headed. Coulees all seasonally run some water, some of them, but all fairly dry. It's very similar. These crossings are, quite a mix of slides up, and we would never know. But this is the last crossing. And this is the road. This is an existing open road on our travel plan. It goes up to here, down there, and hits a bullwhacker road up on top. Cross here, and the next slide would be, now we're back in sage-grouse habitat again. And there's the existing bullwhacker road. Branding up just north of where the east side route would hit the road. So once again, just a quick summary. That last set of pictures, the 25 slides, started at the Cow Island Road and south followed this line roughly around the private property to that point there from the road. So we wanted to give people a feel of what the country looks like. It's very difficult to go out there and find a spot and to look at it. Especially this time of year, we were lucky to get the field work done just in time. Our preliminary archaeological analysis didn't find anything at all on the east or west side routes, but it was just a preliminary go through. This particular project, if we go through the environmental assessment, right, we thought originally we'd have three alternatives. We have no action, we're not building roads, an east side alternative and a west side alternative. Those are our original thoughts. And that's why we brought it out to the public now for scoping to see what everyone thinks about it. We're getting a lot of, I got a lot of responses back. I think I had 50-some electronic responses and a couple dozen written responses. And there was a lot of discussion still about the exchange, a lot of discussion about the roads, and also a discussion about even the trail alternative was brought forward. So our public comment period extends through March 5th. And we'd like to, at this point, we're going to go and typically at this point we open it up for questions. First?
Yeah, I got a few things first.
Okay, how are you? We're going to turn the lights back on.
Yeah, I've got just a couple of quick things here before we offer it up to some questions. One, just to make the point once again, I meant to state, and I think Mike did, they obviously built the road in the right place in the first place. And we're reluctant to move on this. We do have two viable options, but to make the point that they're pretty tough options and they're pretty expensive options. Every time we got to questions at the last three meetings, there's two questions that come up, so I thought I'd just bring them up first. One is, can we revisit the Blaine County decision? And everyone said, well, it's pretty obvious, it's been used since 1920 and earlier, can we just revisit that? And the answer is no, we cannot. Statute of limitations on a decision like that, a legal decision, is like 60 days. What was that, 5 years ago? So no, we cannot revisit that decision. And the second one is, can we use condemnation? And I'll tell you that our state director would not entertain condemnation. In fact, the BLM does not consider condemnation. I don't know, Mike, if we've had any examples of using that authority in this agency. But if we did, it might well be to build a hospital or something. I doubt whether it would be to guarantee some hunting access or recreation access. So no, there's will be no consideration of condemnation. So as Mike mentioned, we got the three alternatives. We got the east side, we've got the west side. We have no action, and we are considering an alternative of trails. I think that's a non-motorized,
yes,
is what Dave suggested. And the other one is to entertain a land exchange. Again, not necessarily the same one that came up. But if we go to that alternative, we need something that'll work. That's why I'm saying we need to get opinions together. Blaine County, Fergus County, the ranchers, this whole thing called collaboration. It can work, but it takes a lot of effort. So we're willing to entertain that exchange thing again. And it might well be end up be one of the alternatives, I think. That's fair, Mike. We do have, not to put you on the spot too much, but we do have a representative of Mr. Wilkes here this evening, and he said he had something he would like to offer that might fit into a discussion on entertaining a land exchange. Daryl, is that fair enough?
Sure, that's fine.
We'll give Daryl a few minutes here to offer up.
Yeah, just real briefly, my name is Daryl James. I'm out of Helena, and I do work with the Wilkes family, and I think Mr. Finish has stated it very plainly that they're certainly interested and willing to push the restart button on discussions about land exchange. I think we can have to start back at ground zero and decide what needs to be part of that discussion, what ought to be included in the discussion, what ought to be added to it, but then kind of let the process work itself out and decide, you know, what parcels are part of the exchange ultimately, what needs to be added into the discussion. To ensure better public access to a pretty tremendous elk herd in Fergus County, and also make sure that that they can assist in opening up access to the bullwhacker, which has been one of the BLM's statewide priorities. And just to reiterate what Mr. Bennett started with, you know, when the Wilkes approached the BLM a couple of years ago. It really was about, okay, how can we get rid of this nuisance inholding within the NBAR? We'd just like to consolidate our ranching operation, get rid of these inholdings, and we look at your priorities and your directives, which are also to try to consolidate lands and for ease of management. It looked like a no-brainer, and they are sincerely interested in helping to open up the breaks. We attempted to open the roadway access last year. under the notion that we were going to be working in good faith with the BLM on the land exchange. There were a couple of miscues and a little stumble, and it came off the table, and we said, well, let's pull back on that. So as soon as we're able to engage in a meaningful discussion about a land exchange and start going through the valuation process and deciding how it would work and what would be involved, we'd like to reopen access to the Bullwhacker as quickly as possible. And also talk about how to improve general hunting access within the NBAR and the surrounding area. So I think I'd leave it at that for now, Stan, and be happy to answer questions, or I'd kind of like to hear what people are thinking tonight before I go any further on what we're thinking.
We'll let Mike entertain some questions here. Should be more I can.
Yeah, how we've done this in the past, we've done three separate meetings. Usually by now people are itching to ask a question. And we spent probably an hour going through discussions, and if we don't have the answer now, we'll get it for you later. We have a few people, unfortunately, who are ill. Our wildlife biologist couldn't make it, nor our geologist. But hopefully we can answer most of the questions. And once again, in summary, if I can do it real quickly, if I'm going looking forward on this environmental assessment, we're going to question first is environmental assessment and environmental impact statement. It appears we have two viable routes that if we had to build a road, we could physically. Physically, it appears to build a road. Looks like it's going to be expensive. Looks like the design and building is normal design, design and normal construction techniques. Build a road on either the east or the west side. There's no big engineering other than cost benefit on either, at least what I can see right now. We have a public comment period, scoping period goes through March 5th. We've got a lot of people interested in this, and we have been getting a lot of comments about going back to include an exchange alternative, looking at a non-motorized alternative, and so we want to wait till obviously the end of the public involvement period before we start to analyze this. So now, what we've done in the past, I just open up the floor and I'll pass the, they've asked the question. You want to speak, a comment? You, sir?
I just wanted to know, is it correct that the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation or someone else has offered to help you financially build that road?
I'm going to have Stan speak on that. I know they have, but I don't
it's kind of an informal discussion, John. They said they are very interested in helping. There was no numbers. There was nothing specific. They just said that if we got to the point we were entertaining a road, they would certainly visit with us on some kind of financial support.
I don't have an official title to offer you, but I am part of the group of hunters who raised the initial opposition to the land exchange as it was originally discussed between the Wilkes and their properties in the Anchor Ranch and the BLM and its properties in the Derby Hills. As I hear what Mr. James is saying, I don't think hunters want to take any opportunities off the table. Whatever those discussions may be about prospective future negotiations and offering of properties for exchange, whatever that may be, I don't think we want to stop that discussion from taking place. What I think we will object to is if you try to stop the road construction process until some future date uncertain that might produce a land exchange. We would want to see this process go forward with all deliberate speed to a logical point where someone would have to offer a land exchange option that is realistic, that would be worth putting this on hold until we work through that one way or the other. The basic point is we're not of closed minds about future opportunities. We do want to see this environmental analysis reach a record of decision at some point in the very near future.
Thank you.
Did you raise your hand?
This is more of a comment than a question, because I was a little surprised by what I heard tonight. I guess the question that it's actually still a question. I would just like the folks from BLM to address a couple of comments that Stan had made earlier about the original exchange, when you presented this to the public, and talking about how some of these proposals lack sufficient public support. And I was wondering what process there was to determine that, because my group, the Friends of the Missouri Breaks Monument, never got a chance to formally just give comments about any of these things that were supposedly on the table.
Yes, that's a question that we got a couple times, and I explained that by, no, we did not pursue this public process because of all the mandated things we had with our staff. Like I said, we had so much on the table. The common sense of the situation was that we would not pursue this because there was little probability of success, because there was some imminent legal opposition. We were quite convinced we would go with. So there was quite a bit of discussion whether to move this forward at the time or not. And with all we had going in the probability of success, once again, we just didn't think. So we did make sure, we said the public needs to know. So if you recall, we did offer up the maps and the discussion. Here is the official proposal that was in the Billing Gazette and several other papers, and we did get a long list of email comments in particular. So I don't know if it's exactly correct to say nobody was notified and you didn't get a chance to come in.
Oh, no, I didn't say nobody was notified. What I'm saying is, what was the actual public process? Was there scoping? Were there public meetings? I know there was a lot of information in the press and on the internet, but as far as, you know, like what we're doing tonight and what we've done in Lewistown and Chinook and Great Falls in December, we didn't see that happen.
No, and there's a number of land exchange proposals that come through, because anybody can offer a proposal. It has to be in the public interest, and there's a long public process, and we make those decisions pretty regularly. There's probably a half dozen others that could have been brought to public meetings, and we just come to the same realization that we don't have the wherewithal to move this forward. We're not saying there wasn't some support. There was some support, certainly, but not to the level we thought we could move it forward, and not with the staffing we had to do so.
Well, but I'm just saying there was no formal process. I didn't recall a deadline for comment. I mean, there is a lot of support, or was, for that initial proposal, and could have been for the second one had the actual kind of public process been followed. So I'm really, happy to hear that this is now going to be part of this EIS process, that the public will actually get a chance to comment on this.
Yeah, well, that's a fair comment. No, we did not take it out to the public. And that's why we brought it back around this time. And the public has told us, essentially, that's not acceptable to us. We would like you to still entertain that, and that's what we hope to do.
So that would make the land exchange to a degree more financially feasible, because it wouldn't take as much. I know it takes time, but it wouldn't take as much budget.
That I don't know. I can't speak for one land exchange side of it. I'll let Mike address that.
Well, I'd offer land exchanges generally go on a value for value, so that doesn't necessarily, not that there's no cost, but.
Mike, I think you have a question?
Yeah.
This is not very good for sound.
Thank you. Hey, Mike and Stan, thanks for having me here. Glad to see James here too. I think that's very encouraging. Some of you know I used to be with BLM. Going back 30 years, we were doing roadless, looking for roadless areas. I think I've been on every road in the Missouri River Breaks by then. And I've hunted there for 30 years, since, to the music in about a month. there are another country really well. Your assessment of the roads that you just presented here is very much on track. Build a road is going to be difficult, and then to maintain it so that we can get over it's going to be very, very expensive. So, the other thing I'd like to stress here just a little bit is that the Goldwacker Calgary complex is the largest contiguous block for BLM in the state. On top of that, it's in a national monument, a wild and scenic river. Get into Cow Creek, it's got the Nez Perce National Trail. It's got magnificent scenery. It's got good populations of elk. The most magnificent bighorn sheep in the country. It's got white-tailed deer down on the bottom and mule deer up on top. It's got sharp-tailed grouse. I think it's got a ton of those. It does have sagebrush. It is a magnificent wildlife area. It's a magnificent place to hunt. I think the bigger vision that we all ought to have as a public is to, over time, take advantage of getting the private land out of Bullwhacker and Cow Creek and look at that as a management unit of these magnificent wildlife. And so I really support that we do have road access into the area. I think there's another question about how many roads we keep open relative to the other things that we want to do. But we definitely need to get past the private land for the road. So my recommendation is, Stan, that you look at a full sweep of alternatives. I think by far, any environmental analysis that you make is going to find that east alternative and the west alternative really bad options from the standpoint of impact wildlife and the landscape and the ability to maintain. Those are, I think, an environmental assessment that shows you that. So I would very much encourage you to get the land exchange back on the table again. And it's not a right away that we're buying if you're able to pull that land exchange off. Part of the problem, I think, with so much opposition is looked at as a land exchange with no capital. It's not. It's not a right away. Not just a right, it's a major piece of really high quality ranch habitat in there that would make good habitat for elk and everything else. So it's much more than a right. I would have gone to the Derby Hills on the exchange. I would have partnered because I feel so strongly about the importance of this area. I don't want to give up Derby Hills, but I would certainly do that, plus the other access that has been proposed. In addition to the ranch, if you could work out another kind of land exchange, I would certainly find that very desirable, more desirable, if we could hold on to different things. Anyway, thank you for your meeting here, and I'm glad that James is here. Thank you for coming. So,
sir? Did you have your hand up? I'm sorry, did you hear?
I will.
Okay, no, I thought you had sort of like this. I wasn't sure.
Now, I'm also a member of the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, DLWA. What I hear here is a lot of sentiment to make a land exchange. And if you look at the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, they are every doggone magazine we have, they're showing how they are trying to buy back our land. Why the heck are we trying to give it away? I don't understand that. Give me a break. Keep our land.
Does the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation have the money to buy this property?
Probably not, but they sure have bought a lot of it in the last few years.
This is an incredible piece of property. I spent quite a bit of time down there with the Robinson Commission when they still own this ranch. It is a beautiful piece of property. It is a keystone to this whole Missouri River breaks. It's beautiful. It has everything that you're talking about. It's just breathtaking. And there's no reason to chop it up with another road. It's a gorgeous road that's there. It, like you said, it's where it's supposed to be. And it just would be a travesty to cut up the land for this thing.
Prior to 2011, before the Wilkes owned the Robinson Ranch, what was your plan, and when was there a budget for the new road?
Back before, when the Robinsons had the road open?
No, when they had it closed.
Stan, I wasn't here at the time, but when they first closed it.
What was the question, Doug?
When they first closed it, what was our plan when they first closed it?
I guess my question is, was there ever in the budget to build a new road into Bullwhacker?
No. No, not until this came up. What? And this public access to so much, the state director said, as we have said so often, public access to public lands is one of the top priorities, and once we lost it, then we started thinking, what could we do?
I'm just asking about the, you'd mentioned before in the paper that Jamie Connell had it on her top priority to get a route into Bullwhacker by last hunting season, say. Prior to the Wilkes owning this, was it in the budget after the Robinsons had closed the road? You didn't have a budget for that road at that time either, is what you're saying?
No.
Okay.
No, what you would like to do and what we had the wherewithal to do are certainly two different things.
What would have been your alternative or your plan to restore access prior to the land exchange proposal? Or had it gotten that far?
Really hadn't gotten that far, Mark. But early on, one of the discussions were to entertain the possibility of the Spencer Ridge route.
Yeah, it not feasible.
East here, and that crossed private land and grazing association and an ACEC, and that just turned out to be. We actually thought, could we get some access while all the discussion went on? And then we didn't make that work either. The association would entertain that easement.
Question over here. Excuse me, more of a comment. Excuse me. My name is Bernard Lee, the Public Land Access Association. And the Bullwhacker Road, if it would have been appealed, is a public road. I put the notebook together, researched the county records in the BLM office, and found evidence that that road existed prior to patent and prior, and would give, had been open to the public for probably 80, 90 years before it was closed. I have to stand here in front of you, and I'm glad my wife's not here, and admit that I made a mistake. As part of POWA, we should have been part of the lawsuit. We would have appealed it to the Supreme Court, and based on recent history of our court cases, there is a prescriptive or RS-2477 access. That being said, stand right. We can't go back, unfortunately. But that is the place for the road. And I agree that the land exchange has to be on the table. Because I cannot believe, I worked for the Forest Service for 36 years, made a lot of land exchanges. There is something workable out there. And the thing to do for the BLM, in my opinion, is we find an alternative that will work and never base your decision on the fact and say, tell me you don't have money. I was also involved in the Gulf purchase several years ago. We worked on land exchange there for 2 or 3 years. Suddenly direction came from a higher level than any of us would have imagined, that the money was there to buy the Gulf land. It was done in 3 months, appraisal, timber survey, everything. So maybe we should contact some political people, our representatives and senators, and get their input on this and where they stand on it. And I don't think we should throw out an alternative to go to the Wilkes Brothers and ask if they're willing to sell it so we can have that access and that road into the monument. Thank you.
I have a couple questions. How many standards of roads do you guys consider, or to what construction standards? Do you have a tier program when you build roads?
Yes, we do. I'd let the engineer speak, but what we anticipated, this would be very similar to if we built a new road, very similar to the existing level, which we would call a local road, is that correct? Okay. How many levels do we have?
Actually, collector, local, and resource.
So was this in the middle?
Yeah, it would go to more than one place, but it's not a major road.
is there a way to consider the cheaper road? Would you call it a resource?
What I had looked at was a single lane road, whether it was local or resource, to try and wanted to keep the footprint as small as we could and cut costs down. So you could build things to a steeper slope if it was a resource road, but not significantly different. But really, the kinds of construction, it would look pretty much the same. It could be a little bit tougher, not as comfortable, you couldn't drive it as fast, but it really wouldn't change it a lot, you know, price-wise. It's our standards that we have in our monument plan for how to build a road, and the grades, the gel grades and everything, and safety, it really wouldn't make it that much cheaper. And it actually...
More expensive to maintain?
Yeah, it could make it a little easier to maintain. We'd have more latitude to do certain things, but it's 5.25 miles of road in tough country either way. And just getting the thing stable again is going to be the trick. But you put a large fill across a drainage, and then you think about needing a guardrail, maybe a gravel that section of the road instead. That's all in the future when we talk about what we're doing. But it's certainly a kind of a minimal road for, you know, for the setting it is. It shouldn't be a two-lane highway. We certainly aren't imposing that.
I can add one thing also, that this is not just hunting access. This is a major access into the National Monument. And many people go down, for instance, we have the Gilmore Cabin down there, beautiful views down off Left Coulee Airstrip and Bullwhacker Airstrip, and people camp down there, not just during hunting season. So the road, logically, we thought, we have to at least match what's below it, below the private land. We wouldn't have any less than what exists there currently. So we want people, at least while weather permits and dry, that you could get a two-wheel drive pickup down there, for instance, because that's what existed prior to that. So that's why we need drainage structures. We need protection for the road. If we build it, we're only going to build it once. We're going to have to put head walls on culverts. We're going to have to probably do a lot of extra work to keep that road in place. So that's why it's not just hunting access, because then we might look at differences. It's rather, it's access.
Year-round.
Yeah, not necessarily year-round, but at least seasonally.
For any kind of outdoorsman.
It's not just the hunters in the fall.
Yep.
I think Hugo... Thank you, Joe.
Educational presentation tonight has certainly given me a picture of what that country looks like. Until tonight, this has been my main view of that part of the country. And then, of course, thanks to Google Earth, I've overflown it a number of times. The road tonight has been characterized as an expensive project. We're going to say $600,000 for the east side, half again as much for the west side. I say cheap at twice the price. You don't figure out whether to build a road based on how much it costs. You build a road on what the benefit is. What I saw in the presentation tonight, and the point was made here, there's already a road in the best place. Building a road on either side would disturb the countryside, be highly visible, and seems a way worse alternative than to use the existing road as it is. The point that you make about exchanges and the like, about wanting to give away our land, seems to me that this is an opportunity to buy a piece of land that restores this access. Point's been made that this is really the keystone to this area. And if you look at the terrain, I can see that that's the case. The point was made earlier that maybe the whole issue of the land exchange was not vigorously discussed in the public. And I can agree with that. I think maybe this is a good time to revisit the land exchange, to look at what can be done to make it happen, and look at it from the standpoint of now, should access be returned but how best to return the access. And if the best way to access this country is along the existing side of the road, then I say we find a way to make that happen.
So what is your name?
My name is George Bauer. I live here in Billings.
I think Hugo is next to the good
one. My name is Hugo Turek, and I'm pretty well known, I think, on both sides of the aisle here. I sat on the Wildlife Federation board. At the same time, I was sitting on the Montana Wilderness Society board, which was an interesting place to be. I happen to be also one of the only ranchers, few ranchers, that have served on the Wildlife Federation board. At present, I happen to also be the chairman of the Friends of the Missouri Breaks National Monument. But what I have to address now is not from the chairman's perspective, it's from my own. I also should point out I'm a public lands rancher. I ranch outside of Coffee Creek on Mullins Arrow Creek Hill on Highway 80. Maybe some of you have had the privilege of going down that recently during this construction. If you have, you understand exactly what happens in Breaks Country. And my daughter trying to haul cows out of there the other day, back up to the top where it got, should take long this time of the year. She called me and said, you're going to have to come down and pull me out. Stuck on the hill. So that's it. But what I want to address is, first of all, to you, you said you were glad your wife wasn't here. My wife would have been very proud if I would have stood up and said what you just said. I was always wondering why it was not appealed. It always bothered me because it was a done deal for appeal. I'm convinced. My knowledge of the Supreme Court, my knowledge of friendliness in Montana of the courts, to sportsmen. And in fact, I would like to back off for 1 second. When I was on the Wildlife Federation board, the governor at that time came and was on the bridge access bill and said, we can't get anybody to work from the agricultural community. Nobody will work with us. So they came, I was, who was the chairman, or who was the federation director at that time?
Craig Sharp.
Yeah, Craig Sharp. So Craig came to me and said, you know, what could we do? And I started to think about it. He said, why don't we broaden out the number of farm organizations? Why don't we talk to others? So I went and talked to, went and met with the Farmers Union. And I remember that meeting so well. When we got done, after he had made his presentation, Craig did, this little old lady got up there who was on the board with the Montana Farmers Union and said, well, isn't that part of the stream access bill? And Craig said, yeah. She says, my God, that's sacred. We got to protect that. And then we went and talked to the Montana Cattlemen's Association, the Northern Plains Resource Council, and those three organizations got on board and moved from the legislature, the Bridge Access Bill. And so, you know, the Wildlife Federation played a huge role, but so did the agricultural communities. Well, I've taken on this pretext. I also should point out that I was the original RAC that worked with Secretary Babbitt on the designation of the Upper Missouri Breaks National Monument. And I can't say I was in favor at the beginning, but once it was declared, and when it was declared, it was really interesting because what Secretary Babbitt did was protect hunting, grazing, and protected that landscape. And I just want to see it protected forever. And when I look at this anchor ranch, right in the middle, going down, 5.5 miles, that hunters now would have to drive and not be able to get off to go hunting, except be dumped down in the coulee at the end. But think, if all that land belonged in the monument, how that would improve the access, because on either side of the anchor ranch, it's monument land. For as far as the eye can see, it's part of that great landscape. And that's why I'm here saying, I think we need to put everything back on the table. And let's open this process up. And in the process of this, start talking to also conservation groups, because I've noticed tonight, MWA's here. They have an interest. See, when we asked for public comment, we were doing the hearings on the creation of monument. We have thousands and thousands of letters, and not that many were from hunters. They were from conservationists, from people who just enjoyed it. So please, let's put it back on the table. Let's get it out there, open it up, and get the public involved. Thank you.
I've been to say my name before, Ron Moody. I live in Lewistown. If anybody in central Montana has skin in the game for the Upper Missouri Breaks National Monument, it's Ron Moody. I moved to Lewistown in 1998. The discussion started later that year and really became strong in 1999, and I was the local boots on the ground point man for the as a member of the Wildlife Federation Board of Directors, advocating for some elevated level of protection for that area, which eventually became a monument. And I still wear that badge or that stigma, depending on who you're talking to in Fergus County. I said all that to say this. Nothing that I'm saying here will, in my mind, be adverse to the best management of that monument. But I have to say that putting land exchanges back on the table does not mean that the only people who get to decide what land gets exchanges are advocates for the Upper Missouri Breaks National Monument. You're not going to be the only team on the field. And we hunters are not going to let you throw our interest under the bus in order to get what you want for your precious monument. If that's what you try to do, it's going to be a long, hard, tough fight. We hunters got into this because we heard, quote unquote, we heard on the street for up to 2 years that a deal was being negotiated for a land exchange to swap the Durfee Hills for the Bullock. Am I right on this, guys? We were not part of that discussion. Other people who seem to think that they didn't have an opportunity to be part of that discussion were, but we were not. And we raised the objection that we did in an organized fashion in producing that petition with 1,600 signatures because we knew that the Durfee Hills parcels were of unique and intrinsic and elevated value that we were not willing to exchange under anything like the terms that we were hearing and which in fact became a public presentation of the exchange proposal in the end. There are values associated with isolated landlocked publicly owned parcels like the Durfee Hills parcels that are precious to people in Montana, and we will not give those up unless it is a really good deal. And if we can see that our children and our grandchildren will be beneficiaries of a really good deal. If you want to make a deal, Mr. James, it's going to be a good one. It's not going to be a deal from our side. But if it's a good one, we will talk to you.
I did say this was a challenging issue, and it certainly has its measure of passion from those that have been involved here. I just wanted to say, I also said early on that I'm optimistic that there's an option out there we can all rally around. I do appreciate Mr. Moody and Hugo both saying we need to keep the options on the table, but everyone needs to get involved in this. So one of the lighter moments of all this journey was when someone told me, Stan, you and your optimism, if you can find that opportunity to rally people around that we can get everybody behind, then you have got some opportunity when you retire. You can go help in Middle East negotiations. Come to work on it. Other questions? Go ahead.
I was just wondering what road you would close if you built a new one.
Okay. That has not been decided at all, but it would be part of an environmental assessment. We went into that, and once again, I would anticipate alternatives in that also. So at this time, we have no list of roads like. If we built these 5 miles, we'd close these 10. I'm glad you brought that up, sir, because I've been getting a few comments of that. What should we be looking at giving up? And I would be getting comments written or with our email or written down. If you have ideas of roads that should be closed, if we go this route, if we end up building a road, that will be part of the decision. But
how
as of now,
the same they don't quality have any of land? How about the same quality of land?
You, sir, next, and then Frank.
Make sure that we brought a lot of copies of that area, and everybody take one of those with them. That could be a good way to get your voice heard.
My name is John Gibson. I'm president of Public Land and Water Access. Have I got a recommendation for you on roads? There's a whole lot of roads in that country that are basically private roads on public land. By that I mean somewhere near the beginning of a piece of public land, is a piece of private land that blocks that road. And that means the public can't use it. But the guy that owns that piece of land can use it, and his outfitter can use it, and his friends can use it. My recommendation is this. If there's a public road on public land, then it better be open to all of us, or else it ought to be closed. That's my position. This is our land, and we don't want exclusive use by people on this land any more than there is. A couple of other points. I'm like Bernie. I've been involved at land exchanges, too. And he's talking about a political decision that came from the very top when he says it was done in 3 months. But let me tell you about this one. All of the opposition that you had, and that includes, frankly, as a public land and water access, the opposition to a land, that land exchange that included the Durfee Hills. With all of that opposition and 7 years, if you think you can do it for $500,000, you're very optimistic, because I don't think you can. That's a long, tough process. And the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation is nobody to fool with. And frankly, neither is Public Land and Water Access or the Montana Wildlife Federation. You know, come on. Look at the country up there. Those roads, there's roads all over that country, and some of them are built on exactly the same kind of situation that you're dealing with. I'm afraid that the land exchange is going to be used as a reason to delay, 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 and never get anywhere. And the road won't be built. Build the road.
What would be the process for deciding what would be included in the land exchange proposal? Would there be, would they have to come to you with a proposal and then you say, no, but we'll consider this, or not? What's the,
well, the process, and people talk about some negotiations going on. There was some discussion going on, but there, I kept telling folks, we need a formal proposal. So here we are back entertaining a land exchange. We need a formal proposal. Now, I was hoping we might get it, something generated either from the Wilt side, or we get Blaine County or our county people working together to come up with an opportunity. But anyway, it'll be hopefully a collaboratively formed proposal. It'll be a formal proposal, and that will go back out again for this same kind of public review. I don't know if that's an answer for you, but.
My name's Doug Crings. I'm from Lewistown. Heard a lot of people offer up the Durfee Hills. Let's get that back on the table. Let's get that back on the table. I can guarantee not a one person that said that has been there. Maybe with the exception of Daryl James, because his, you know, the book thought that you want that in their hand holdings. Some simple math will tell you that a $500,000 road equates to $20 an acre of bullwhacker.
Ten. Half a million's ten. $20 a million.
I'm very upset with anybody just offering up the Durfee Hills. If they want to come up with a land exchange, they're not going to include that, because there's nothing that compares. And I encourage anybody to talk to me about it after this. I can show you pictures. I can take you there.
I just wanted to make the comment that I haven't been to the Durfee Hills, because the only way to access them is by plane. And I was in full agreement with what John Gibson said earlier about how lands should not be just accessible to a few people. If they're public lands, they should be accessible to everyone. That's why I really can see why it's important to have this land back in the public, or in the public domain, so that all of us can get in here without having to have an airplane. I mean, we could get in there right now. There's two airstrips in this area, and there's another one off to the left over here. And
we can hike.
To play devil's advocate, I mean, if air access was good enough for the Durfees, shouldn't it be enough for the bullwhacker? I mean, I'm being facetious, but I think it's a logical question.
I don't own an airplane either.
No, there's foot traffic into bullwhacker also.
Just one point. I talked to the executive director of the Mont.
I just talked to the executive director of the Montana Wildlife Federation. The Montana Wildlife Federation has not taken a stand on this issue.
Oh, boy.
Gee, I don't know if I ought to throw this in. Well, I might get to my truck to get home tonight. But there was some concern about finances. I know that looking around Billings, if I have a horse and I take it to a private pasture, I'm going to pay $25 to $30 a month. Now, the Roche brothers probably have some BLM money. They're paying something like $1.35 AUM a month. Why don't we jack up the price on the AUM? Why doesn't BLM jack up the price on AUM? That'd be a nice way to pay off that road.
Talked out to a degree, but what we've done in the past is we've stayed around if people want to talk to us individually and go over the maps and have specific questions about where spots are, coolies, or things like that. That's when you should break down anything. Daryl, would you please?
Go ahead and finish it, and then I'll give you one final thought here.
Maybe after this comment, we could break out in small groups, and anybody wants to speak to myself or Stan or Carl or anyone else, so we can go stay as long as you need to.
Thanks, Mike.
Just want to kind of follow up on some of the comments I've heard, and I appreciate the discussion tonight. I want to focus on a couple of things that are important to the Wilkes. And again, I hit on this earlier, that they're truly interested in opening up more territory for more people in Montana through this exchange.
Yes.
We haven't talked about the numbers of acres that are involved, but Stan touched on it earlier. There's about 50,000 acres of terrain within the breaks that would be opened up through the exchange. That's not counting the acreage within Fergus County that would be opened up with the exchange properties off of Red Hill Road, about 10,000 acres that are currently inaccessible. You can argue about this. If you're young and strapping and willing to go through some massive coulees, you can get to that territory through a 40-acre parcel that the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation purchased. But the 10,000 acres, not by our estimate, but by BLM Forest Service estimate, 10,000 acres would be opened up off of Red Hill Road. We've also talked just recently about a permanent access easement off of Red Hill Road that would connect east-west between those two chunks of Forest Service property, between the Big and Little Snowies. Permanent wildlife corridor, permanent access between those areas. Also talking about between 20 and 25,000 acres in the NVAR that would be in block management. So if we're going to talk about access and truly serving more people in Montana, more U.S. taxpayers with access to elk herds, access to private or to not only public lands but also to private lands for more than just hunting, the Wilkes are putting this on the table. Whoever told you that is absolutely right. We will not satisfy everybody. There are isolated interests here. 40 to 50 people a year get to hunt in the Durfee Hills. It's a great area. Nobody's going to dispute that. But that's not public access. So the Wilkes are sincerely interested, want to find a solution that opens up more territory to more people in Montana for a broad range of uses, not just hunting. But they recognize the hunting. They're hunters themselves. They're archery hunters. They love the Durfee Hills. They love the NVAR. They love the Anchor Ranch. We've talked about opening up the Anchor Ranch. He's going to tell me there's only like 35 tags out there for bull tags in that Anchor Ranch area. We're talking to Fish, Wildlife, and Parks right now about how do we open that up? Can we get more access? Can we issue more tags? What do we need to do to improve that area for more people? That's what they want to try to do. So we've asked for ideas on what would make an exchange reasonable to a broad range of people. Nobody's brought anything back to us. We're more than welcome, more than willing to listen. But tell us where to start. We've thrown things out on the table and they've all been rejected. So let's keep the dialogue going. We'd love to hear ideas and to keep this moving forward. We're not interested in installing this. We'd love to have a solution. But it has to be reasonable for everybody.
I need to speak to this term public access. The term reasonable public access has been a
political football for as long, for the full 25 years that I've been involved in conservation politics, is trying to arrive at a definition of that term for purposes of negotiating with private landowners, public hunting access, private property, et cetera, on down the line. There is already public access to the Bull Whacker watershed. By foot, by river, there's already public access there, equivalent to what there would be to the Scapegoat Wilderness. The piece of business at hand here in this environmental analysis for which we're doing scoping, it is whether the BLM should restore
motor vehicle access to this piece of terrain up here. It's not whether there is public access or not public access, but should we restore previously existing motor vehicle access to that area? And I will reiterate that whatever discussions take place on other exchanges, whatever, that the hunters are going to want to see BLM proceed with all deliberate speed to come as close to a record of decision on this environmental analysis as possible. But just because the Burpee Hills parcels are landlocked and only accessible air does not mean that they do not have public access. That is public access. It is one form, not all forms, but that is public access, just like a foot trail in a bull rider is public access. Now, this original discussion raised a whole new question in the minds of the hunting public in this state. Is forever now, we have looked at isolated landlocked public parcels as good trade goods because we couldn't get to them by trucks. And so, yeah, let's talk about trading those things. Now, all of a sudden, we see the trend, and this is much larger than the single family named Wolves, of wealthy people creating massive land holdings in this state. If I had the money, that's where I would put it, in buying rural land. And what that creates is the scenario 10 years, 20 years, 30 years down the line here, that the only public hunting access that we will have in a very large part of Montana, like the eastern two-thirds of it, much of it is going to be only by air. And that the pickup truck-centric hunting culture of Montana is going to have to take on some of the characteristics of the Alaskan hunting culture and become much more aviation-oriented. And so that was a component of our reasoning of why, you know, if only 40 or 50 or 60, it's more like 60 or 70 people fly into the Burpee Hills every hunting season to hunt. Those hills are not that big. That's all the hunting pressure that area can take. That's all it can take. It might even be a little too much. So when you throw out a number, well, only 40 to 50 people fly in there every year, okay, it's not the Rocky Mountain front or anything. It's a small area. Not very many people can hunt that area. There are thousands of areas like that in Montana that are always going to be only accessible by air as the holdings around them grow in size.
Okay, thank you.
Michael, let's try and wrap up the questions. We're crowded 8 o'clock.
First, I just want to thank everybody for coming out and putting up your evening on this. And very quick, just going to summarize. Some of you have been at the other meetings, but this is our fourth meeting at one in Great Falls, one in Chinook and Lewistown. And this is representative of I think, all of them. We've had some heated discussions, some emotional concerns. But everybody that we've spoken to is very concerned about access. And what we did hear again and again at all the meetings is that many people are still interested in renewing some extension proposal. People are looking at different types of routes than what we had. We originally had the two motorized routes, east, west, and no action. So I want to remind everybody that March 5th is the deadline for comments. And We have comment forms, but you can comment by email, by written. But please try to write them down. It really helps us. If we go back and analyze these and look at these comments, we have some big decisions to make on whether we're going to expand these alternatives or what they're going to look like. And obviously, there's a lot of water yet to go under this bridge. That's my opinion. I'd like to say I very much enjoyed speaking with you tonight and hearing everybody's interest. And very, very even. But they're very interesting. Very much like the Great Falls meeting, the one that should have been one of those. Stan, any last words?
Once again, thanks for coming. As I did say a couple times, it's a challenging issue.
May I say one? Mark? Real quick, yep. I'm Mark Schwellmeyer, and I'm the president of the Central Montana Outdoors. And if the land exchange does come back on the table, I can say on behalf of us, are there 12 parcels, 11 parcels? If the two large parcels were left out and left to the public, we would support a trade 100%.
We're here if you want to visit for more, ask some questions, fine, but otherwise we'll try and stop this up. Thanks again for coming.